Thanks so much, David. So as David mentioned, I'm going to be doing a deep dive into one of the major catalysts for internal investigations, and that's whistleblowing, particularly in this Dodd-Frank era. There's been a huge surge in whistleblowing in just the last few years, and I'll refer to that as the perfect storm of whistleblowing. I'm sure many of you have had to deal with whistleblowers in the course of your work, whether it's in the context of investigating their internal complaints or handling threatened or filed whistleblower retaliation claims, or both, or perhaps the SEC just comes knocking and you don't know whether it's because of a whistleblower complaint or not. Whistleblowers and whistleblower complaints need to be handled properly in order to minimize a company's risks. And the best practices with regard to handling whistleblower complaints aren't always obvious or even intuitive. So today I'm going to go through the current legal landscape with regard to whistleblowing, a few cases that reflect some of the common pitfalls that some companies have fallen into, and then sum up with some best practices in light of the perfect storm of whistleblower activity. So first, what is the perfect storm of whistleblower activity? It's a combination of factors that have all arisen at the same time just in the last few years. The first is that there have been massive statutory and regulatory changes in whistleblower protections and new monetary incentives through the Dodd-Frank bounty provisions. There have been more enforcement actions by prosecutors and regulators. There's also been an invigorated plaintiff's bar that's been encouraging whistleblowers to come forward. And this isn't just the typical whistleblower lawyers of the past who were typically in the employment law arena, but now it's also plaintiffs' class action, securities class action counsel getting in on this as well because of the SEC Dodd-Frank bounty provisions, and they bring great resources to bear. And finally, there's been dramatic changes in the interpretation of whistleblower protections in the courts and in administrative agencies that have also been encouraging more whistleblowers to come forward. So I'm first going to go through the legislative front and the legislative changes that have been going on, and that's slide 3 of my of ORIX PowerPoint presentation. And as we all know, Sarbanes-Oxley was enacted in 2002, and then Dodd-Frank was enacted in 2010. Dodd-Frank contains 3 whistleblower schemes, and in addition to that, amended Sarbanes-Oxley to make it more whistleblower-friendly. So in addition to the amendments to Sarbanes-Oxley, there is Section 922 of Dodd-Frank, which is the SEC's whistleblower scheme, and that contains both a bounty provision and an anti-retaliation provision. There's Section 748 of Dodd-Frank, which is the Commodity Futures Trading Commission's whistleblower scheme, which is similar to the SEC's scheme in that it contains both a bounty provision and an anti-retaliation provision. And then there's Section 1057 of Dodd-Frank, which is the Consumer Financial Protection whistleblower provision, and which is much lesser known, and that's in part because it didn't take effect until a year after Dodd-Frank's passage. And that contains an anti-retaliation provision for employees who do work in the consumer finance area, which is basically any financial products that are not geared toward institutions but are geared toward individuals and families. So to the extent your companies offer any of those, then there is a potential cause of action for your employees under Section 1057 of the Dodd-Frank Act as well. The Dodd-Frank bounty provisions provide that whistleblowers who come to the SEC with original information derived from independent knowledge or analysis about violations of securities laws will be awarded a share of between 10% and 30% of the monetary sanctions imposed by the commission to the extent that that sanctions are $1 million or more. And I said will be awarded, and that's deliberate because the statute does not leave discretion to award bounties to eligible whistleblowers who go to the commission. If the whistleblowers are eligible, they shall receive a bounty of between 10 and 30%. The SEC has been touting the program as highly successful. They're receiving nearly 10 tips a day, over 3,000 tips a year, and they've been saying that the tips are of much higher quality than those that they received before the bounty program came into effect. And the awards under the bounty program so far total over $45 million. Now, one important note with regard to that is that 2 of the whistleblower awards were for $30 million and $14 million. So those 2 awards make up 44 of the $45 million and change, and there are several other 6-figure awards in addition to that. Turning to slide five of the PowerPoint, this is an interesting chart, and it's put out by the SEC's Office of the Whistleblower. Over 10% of the SEC's tips for its bounty program have been coming from outside of the United States, and this number has been relatively consistent since the inception of the program, although it's been going up slightly. And the countries where the tips are most commonly from are perhaps not a surprise. The UK, China, India, and Canada, our neighbor to the north, are the four countries that that get the most that are providing that whistleblowers are providing the most tips from outside of the U.S. And in fact, the SEC has in its most recent report disclosed that four of the 14 whistleblower awards it's made to date have been to non-U.S. residents. So the SEC is awarding bounties to foreign residents. In addition, the SEC has awarded two awards in 2014 to whistleblowers who reported to their companies first. They have over 40% of the award recipients thus far were current or former company employees, and another 20% were contractors or consultants or were solicited for such roles from companies. So a majority of the whistleblowers who are receiving SEC bounty awards are individuals who are providing services to companies. And in light of that, it just shows how important it is for companies to have policies and procedures that encourage internal reporting rather than whistleblowers going to the SEC in seeking out bounties. Turning to slide seven of the PowerPoint, although some individuals may presumptively not be eligible for bounties, there are certain categories who generally will not be eligible. Attorneys generally are not eligible to the extent that they learn of information through a privileged relationship or through privileged communications, and there generally won't be exceptions to that. And in fact, the New York County Lawyers Association last year put out an ethics opinion stating that at least for New York lawyers, you cannot accept a Dodd-Frank bounty and also be compliant with the New York's ethics rules. With regard to some other types of employees whose job it is to root out and address misconduct, there may be exceptions that swallow the rule. In other words, these individuals, while presumptively unable to receive a bounty, may indeed be eligible to get bounties under certain circumstances. So compliance and internal audit personnel, public accountants who are performing audits for the companies, officers, directors, trustees, or partners of an entity, although generally not eligible for bounties, could become eligible if they believe disclosure may prevent substantial injury to the company, if they believe the company is engaging in conduct that will impede an investigation, or if 120 days have gone by since they reported the information to the company, or since they are aware that the company knew of the information. That 120-day period becomes very important and indeed critical in internal investigations, because that's the time frame within which a company must receive the whistleblower complaint, investigate it, and decide what action needs to be taken, and to do so before the whistleblower gets the opportunity to go to the SEC, whether that's self-disclosing to the SEC, whether that is taking some kind of corrective action. There's that 120-day period that that the company may be able to take action before the whistleblower goes to the SEC and is eligible for a bounty. Even if someone is ineligible for a bounty, it's important to note that they can still they're still eligible for potential relief under the anti-retaliation provisions. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about those provisions. So Dodd-Frank's anti-retaliation provision for securities whistleblowers is a little bit unique in a few ways. And the first way is that the SEC has taken the position in its regulations that it can bring retaliation cases itself. And that's a bit different, and it's almost more similar to the employment context where the EEOC will bring discrimination cases. It's more similar to that. And the SEC is looking for retaliation cases to bring. And this year, it brought its first retaliation case against a hedge fund, and it sanctioned the hedge fund over $2 million for both the retaliation and the underlying conduct that the whistleblower reported. There's currently a split as to what constitutes protected activity under the Dodd-Frank retaliation provision, with the Fifth Circuit and a number of district courts holding that only reports to the SEC are protected activity under the Dodd-Frank Act, and another whole host of district courts holding that internal reporting to the company is also protected under the Dodd-Frank Act. So for now, we're advising companies to treat internal complaints as well as complaints to the SEC as protected whistleblowing under Dodd-Frank. And in any event, such internal whistleblowing is protected under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and so therefore needs to be treated treated carefully in any event. One thing that has become clear in the cases thus far is that although foreign residents are eligible for bounties under the SEC's bounty provision, courts have uniformly held that those non-U.S. residents are not eligible for anti-retaliation protections under the Dodd-Frank Act. Turning to slide 9 of the PowerPoint, this is an important practice point, and it has to do with confidentiality agreements, whether they're in offer letters, separation agreements, handbooks, non-compete agreements, or other confidentiality agreements. Companies, under the SEC's regulations, companies may not take, quote, any action to impede an individual from communicating directly with the SEC about a potential securities law violation, including enforcing or threatening to enforce a confidentiality agreement. So the SEC's Office of the Whistleblower has stated on several occasions that it's actively looking for examples of policies or agreements that may have these issues. And eight House Democrats in October wrote a letter to the SEC urging the SEC to send a strong message. And so the issue here is that many of the typical employment agreements, separation agreements, offer letters will have standard language stating that an employee cannot disclose confidential company information outside of the company. That will not stand up to the SEC's scrutiny in light of this regulation. There needs to be a carve-out in these agreements or some other language stating that nothing in that language is intended to impede individuals from going to the SEC with company information. We've worked with many clients on going through their agreements and making these changes, and the head of the Office of the Whistleblower, Sean McKessie, has said in public remarks that they're looking for examples of these agreements, that they're not only going to go after companies that have problems with these agreements, but they're going to go after the attorneys who drafted the agreements. So this is something where in-house counsel really need to take a careful look at their agreements in light of this Dodd-Frank regulation and make sure that there are the proper carve-outs so that nothing in those agreements that mention confidentiality could be construed as preventing an individual from going outside to the SEC or to other law enforcement. Turning to slide 10, on the Sarbanes-Oxley front, there's been a big development, and that is the first U.S. Supreme Court case interpreting the Sarbanes-Oxley Act's whistleblower provisions, and that's the Lawson v. FMR case. And the Supreme Court interpreted the Sarbanes-Oxley Act whistleblower provisions extremely broadly. The question presented in that case is what employees are covered under the SOX Act, whether it's just employees of publicly traded companies who are covered, or whether it's also all employees of contractors, subcontractors, or agents of public companies, which essentially brings in all private company employees into coverage, because what private company does not have some sort of contract with a public company? So this was an important question, and the Supreme Court decided that went with the broader interpretation and decided that Sarbanes-Oxley covers not only employees of the publicly traded companies themselves, but employees of contractors, subcontractors, and agents of public companies. And one question that's left unanswered by the Supreme Court's decision is what type of reporting is protected by these employees. Is it just reporting about potential fraud at the public companies, or can an employee also be protected whistleblower if he or she makes reports about potential fraud within the private company itself. The Supreme Court didn't answer that question, and so that's going to be a question that's going to be hashed out in the district courts in the first instance, and plaintiffs, whistleblower lawyers are going to, of course, take an aggressive approach and bring whistleblower claims under Sarbanes-Oxley where private companies did not think there would be a cause of action. in addition to in the courts, the Department of Labor also issues decisions under Sarbanes-Oxley, and in the past several years has been issuing some extremely employee-friendly SOX decisions. And that has implications not only for employers who are litigating before the agency, but also in the courts, because the courts have been, for the most part, deferring to the Department of Labor's interpretation of Sarbanes-Oxley in these decisions. So these decisions become either, I wouldn't say precedent, but they become highly persuasive in the courts, both district courts and federal appeals courts. So one issue has been the scope of protected activity. And I write here on slide 11, you think a complaint doesn't implicate SOX? Think again. And that's because of a 2011 Department of Labor case called Sylvester v. Parexel. And Parexel is a clinical drug trial testing company. And a couple of nurses at Parexel alleged that a couple of other nurses had written down the wrong times of taking some blood samples on a few occasions, and they claimed that they were terminated as a result of that report that they made. And they claimed that this was a Sarbanes-Oxley violation. And the Department of Labor agreed, even though these employees didn't raise anything about fraud on shareholders or anything of that nature, the Department of Labor's Administrative Review Board, which hears appeals of these Department of Labor law judge decisions, held that because the wrong writing down of the time of the blood samples could skew the results of the clinical drug trials and could lead to false results, and if the shareholders found out about this, it could cause issues with the share prices or be some sort of shareholder fraud. So it was somewhat attenuated, but the Administrative Review Board at the Department of Labor held that this was Sarbanes-Oxley protected whistleblowing. So in terms of your own companies and employees who are blowing the whistle, even if something may seem not to be about investors or fraud against shareholders at all, legal needs to be informed of these types of whistleblower allegations because they could indeed lead to a Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower complaint. The next question, think an employee did not suffer an adverse employment action? Think again. Just last month, there was a Fifth Circuit decision in a Sarbanes-Oxley case, Menendez v. Halliburton, in which the Fifth Circuit affirmed a decision that the naming of an employee's name in a document preservation notice constituted SOX retaliation. This is an employee, Menendez, who raised concerns internally to the company and then brought his concerns to the SEC. The SEC opened an inquiry, and Halliburton's general counsel sent out a litigation, a document preservation notice stating that the SEC is looking into the concerns raised by Mr. Menendez. And after that notice went out, Menendez claimed that he was isolated, shunned, to the point where he had to resign. And the Fifth Circuit held that, affirmed the decision that the revelation of Mr. Menendez's identity in the litigation hold memo constituted unlawful SOX retaliation. And that can create a difficulty for in-house counsel in drafting litigation hold notices and document preservation notices because, on the one hand, counsel has an obligation to have comprehensive litigation hold and comprehensive document preservation, but on the other hand, does not want to be potentially liable for outing a whistleblower in a litigation hold notice. And so in some instances, that may mean, you know, to the extent that there could be a fulsome notice that doesn't include the employee's name, then that's great. If employee data does have to also be preserved, then sometimes it has to go a little broader than one employee. It may have to be directed toward a group or of employees in order that the one individual's name is not revealed in a litigation hold notice. And, of course, it's a case-by-case determination. Finally, firing an employee for stealing company data, not so fast. And that is referring to a recent case, Vinoy v. Celanese Corp., in which Celanese terminated an employee after it learned the employee had sent a whole host of company data, including 1,600 current and former employee Social Security numbers, to his domestic partner's email account. And he was terminated after the company discovered that and after Vinoy refused to participate in an investigation of alleged misconduct that he raised. And the Department of Labor held at the trial, Benoit said, well, I took this information because I was going to make a whistleblower complaint to the IRS. And in light of that, the department held that that he was fired for protected whistleblowing, that the taking of the confidential information was protected because he was using that information to make a whistleblower complaint. And it was sort of, it was basically undisputed that not all of the information got forwarded to the IRS, but because it was facilitating an IRS whistleblower complaint, then that activity in taking the confidential data was protected. And that sort of gets back to the SEC's regulation that I mentioned earlier under Dodd-Frank, that companies may not take any action to impede individuals from going to the SEC with information. And so again, this becomes a very tricky area. When you learn of, of an employee misappropriating company documents, it's not a slam dunk, yes, you can terminate that individual anymore in this new whistleblower environment. It may be that you still do, but there has to be a careful determination made. You need to look at the documents. You need to determine whether this could be a potential whistleblower and whether you could have some potential whistleblower liability on your hands when you're making that decision. So turning to slide 12, I've come up with some best practices for dealing with employees, whistleblowers, in light of the perfect storm. And the overall theme here is that whistleblowers need to be, feel that they're a valued member of the organization in order to feel comfortable going to a going to the company with concerns instead of going straight to a regulator, which is just the worst case scenario. And employees are more likely to go to a regulator or pursue litigation if they feel that their complaints won't be handled appropriately if they're made, if their complaints aren't taken seriously by their managers or whoever else they report them to, or if their complaints aren't dealt with promptly. So in light of that, I've come up with 10 best practices, starting on slide 13. And the first is pretty basic, and I'm sure most or all of you have already done this, but it's to make sure that there are numerous avenues available to make complaints, including anonymous complaints. And that may be managers, who are often the first line to receive these complaints, human resources, compliance, telephone hotline, website. And in addition, these different methods need to be well publicized in your handbooks and wherever you have employee information so that there's no doubt in employees' minds that they can go to all of these different places to make complaints. The second one is do not attempt to identify an anonymous whistleblower. And this may run counter to instincts when you're conducting an internal investigation. But knowledge of a whistleblower's identity could lead to potential exposure in a whistleblower retaliation lawsuit. If you don't know who the whistleblower is, it can't be argued that you retaliated against that person for blowing the whistle.
Now, Renee, it's David Rosenfield. We had talked about this earlier. What if it's easy to determine who the anonymous whistleblower is based on the complaint? What should you do? What should the company do then?
Yeah. At that point, it's just minimizing your exposure under the retaliation laws. So urge others, you know, even if you figured it out, do your best to urge other managers or others who it may not be obvious to, not to try to figure it out. If people do figure it out, certainly don't talk about it. Don't email about it. You don't want any record of knowing who the whistleblower is. Don't spread the information further about who the whistleblower is. And also, once you know who that whistleblower is, then the good news is you can take, you know, you can keep an eye on any adverse employment actions that may be in the works and try to ensure that there's no retaliation. But it's a good point, David, because sometimes it's just pretty obvious. Even if someone doesn't pen their name to a complaint, it can be pretty obvious who it is. And in that, if that occurs, it's just trying to minimize the exposure by not spreading that further and by not not making a record of that. So the third point is to train managers on how to properly deal with complaints, because I've seen many whistleblower complaints where individuals have gone to litigation because their managers simply did not respect them when they raised the concerns. And that's just unfortunate because it seems like such an easy way to avoid litigation, to just have a manager who takes a complaint seriously from an employee. So managers should be trained to thank employees for bringing paying forward complaints, telling employees that the company takes complaints seriously, that the complaint will be investigated, that the company has a robust compliance program, and that the company has a no retaliation policy, and if the employee feels any sort of retaliation, to raise it to HR. The fourth recommended best practice is to train managers in HR on what type of complaints may be covered by Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank in light of the huge expansion of the interpretation of protected activity under these laws, so that potential Dodd-Frank and SOX complaints can be immediately referred to legal. Fifth and sixth are to preserve the privilege, and Lee and David will be talking more about that, and informing the audit committee where allegations may be serious, because it may be, you know, the audit committee may have to make the call as to whether to engage outside counsel to investigate and how the investigation is going to go forward, and it may be that the audit committee itself wants to engage the outside counsel. Seventh is to assign a human resources representative to the whistleblower during the investigation. And that person will essentially be a liaison who will occasionally check in with the whistleblower to report on the status, make sure the employee doesn't feel any retaliation, reviewing any management decisions before they occur to make sure that there is no retaliation, and also, finally, and this is important, to circle back to the employee at the conclusion of the investigation and give the employee some information. And it may be that you can't give any details about what was found, but at least telling the employee that we have investigated, the investigation has concluded, the company has taken actions that it believes to be appropriate, and the company appreciates you bringing your concerns forward. Eighth is that legal should track all complaints that are made, all whistleblower complaints that are made, no matter where those complaints originate, in a single system, because even if individual complaints may seem minor or trivial, patterns can demonstrate more serious issues, and by tracking in a single system, those patterns can be recognized. Ninth, I highly recommend periodic compliance questionnaires, and those are annual or semi-annual questionnaires, and they may be to all employees in your company or some subset, asking within the last 6 months, within the last year, have you observed any potential violations of securities laws? Have you observed any antitrust violations? Have you observed any insider trading? Whatever may be relevant to your business, to have employees ask the employees those questions, have them sign off on whether they've seen something or not, because if they have, then you're fleshing this out before it becomes a bigger issue, which could be, you know, very helpful, proactive step for a company to take. And my clients who do this are, they find it indispensable. They would not trade it. It's been extremely helpful. It does require time-consuming administration to handle all of the responses to the questionnaires, but it is well worth it in our experience. But one thing that's important is that once you're doing these questionnaires, you have to handle them appropriately. You have to figure out, you know, where people have raised concerns in the questionnaires and triage the complaints and investigate the complaints quickly, especially with the 120-day deadline in the Dodd-Frank Act. If someone puts that on paper, if someone doesn't even look at that piece of paper for 30 days, then you're down to 90 days to do your whole investigation and decide what action, if any, you're going to take. Finally, the 10th recommended best practice is to review your third-party vendor practices, because it's not only employees in your company, likely, but you have consultants, auditors, hotline administrators, and they could come across concerns or hear of concerns as well. And you don't want them running to the SEC without giving the company a chance to address concerns. So the policies of those vendors also need to be reviewed to ensure that they, too, provide optimal protection in terms of encouraging internal reporting and not having these consultants or others just go straight to the SEC to try to seek a bounty based on alleged misconduct at your company. And so with that, I will turn it over to Lee.